Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, July 24, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we will explore whether existing civil rights policies are based on a statistical understanding that is the opposite of reality. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Jim P. Scanlon, Attorney at Law, and our moderator, Roger B. Clegg, President and General Counsel at the Center for Equal Opportunity. I will turn it over to Jim to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Jim. The floor is yours.
Thank you. I'm going to be talking about a statistical issue that is somewhat complex. And for that reason, I have some materials associated with this teleconference that I would like people to access. And they can be found on my website, jpscanlon.com, or just Googling my name, James Scanlon. And there's the fourth tab says measurement letters, and it'll be the first link on the measurement letters page. And while people are doing that, I'll say there are really two things at issue here. One is the misunderstanding of statistics that I'll be talking about, and that matter is really, in my view, not very debatable. But there's also the issue of whether even an administration that would have a strong interest in understanding this issue may not be able to understand it. Ideally, anyone who is participating with the call who is in a position to facilitate the administration's coming to understand this issue, well, that would be appreciated. That holds for Congress, too, for Congress has never actually understood these issues at all. It, like the government, like the executive branch, has an understanding that's the exact opposite of reality. Now I'll begin following for a time the materials that I just referenced, hoping people will have them now in front of them. And there are about four pages of sort of bullet point issues without bullet points. Thereafter, I'll pick up talking about these issues with reference to a number of tables. And then at the end of the document, there is a sort of bibliography that I really won't discuss here at all. So to begin, well, for decades, civil rights enforcement policies involving lending, school discipline, criminal justice, voting, and employment have been based on a belief that relaxing standards or otherwise reducing the frequency of various adverse outcomes will tend to reduce relative, that is, percentage differences between rates at which more and less susceptible groups experience those outcomes and the proportions more susceptible groups make up of persons experiencing the outcomes. In fact, however, reducing any adverse outcomes tends to increase, not reduce, both of these measures of difference. Because of the government's misunderstanding of this matter, there are many situations whereby acceding to government encouragements to relax standards, entities covered by civil rights laws increase the chances that the government will sue them for discrimination. By way of a simple example, for a long time the government has been concerned about large relative differences in mortgage rejection rates. That is, say, the black rejection rate, 21%, is three times the white rejection rate of 7%. The government has long acted on the belief that if you relax standards, you will tend to reduce that relative difference. In fact, however, you will tend to increase that relative difference. This particular understanding that I'm talking about is part of a larger failure of understanding among persons analyzing demographic differences. In fact, virtually all analyses of demographic differences in outcome rates are unsound for failure to recognize and address the way the measures employed tend to be affected by the frequency of an outcome. That is, no one ever asks whether the pattern I'm observing is simply a function of changes in the frequency of an outcome or whether it indicates something about underlying process that it may be worthwhile studying. Essentially, all analyses involving rates of experiencing some favorable or adverse outcome involving discrimination issues have been fundamentally unsound. And that is so whether the issue is characterized as disparate impact or disparate treatment. The points here, however, apply only to issues involving yes or no outcomes. Mortgage approval versus mortgage rejection, and things like that. They don't apply to continuous variables like loan rates or average salaries of different demographic groups of employees. However, those analyses also suffer from a fundamental problem in that they commonly examine only persons who accepted some outcome or situation, thus failing to examine the entire universe of persons at issue. It's an important issue, but not one I'm actually addressing here. Now, inherent in most distributions of factors associated with experiencing some outcome or its opposite is a pattern whereby the rarer an outcome, the greater tends to be the relative difference in experiencing it, and the smaller tends to be the relative difference in avoiding it, that is, experiencing the opposite outcome. By way of the simplest of examples, and as will be shown in one of the tables below, lowering a test cutoff tends to increase relative differences in failure rates at the same time that it reduces relative differences in pass rates. Corollary pattern is that whereby reducing the frequency of an outcome tends to increase the proportion of more susceptible groups make up of persons who experience the outcome and persons who avoid the outcome. That tends to increase all measures of difference between the proportion that groups makes up of the pool and the proportion it makes up of persons experiencing the outcome, while it tends to reduce the difference between the proportion that group makes up of the pool and the proportion it makes up of persons avoiding the outcome. This aspect of the matter, which I have to address because it is frequently the focus of analyses of disparities in criminal justice outcomes and school discipline outcomes, makes discussion of the issue much more cumbersome. So I'll, to the extent possible, try and focus solely on the relative differences in the favorable outcome and the relative difference in the adverse outcome. Now, some of the more obvious implications of the pattern I describe that relaxing lending, discipline, educational, or job hiring or performance standards while tending to reduce relative difference in meeting the standards will tend to increase relative differences in failing to meet the standards. Limiting the circumstances where a police officer may use force in the course of an arrest while tending to reduce relative differences in rates at which arrestees avoid the use of force will tend to increase relative differences in rates at which arrestees are subject to the use of force. Changing a three-strikes law to a four-strikes law, while tending to reduce relative differences in rates of avoiding being sentenced under the law, will tend to increase relative differences in rates of being sentenced under the law. Reducing the difficulties of securing a voter ID while tending to reduce relative differences in securing such an ID will tend to increase relative differences in failing to secure it. Now, some of the less obvious implications of this pattern is that relative differences in mortgage rejection rates and loan foreclosures will tend to be larger, while relative difference in mortgage approval rates and rates of avoiding foreclosure will tend to be smaller among higher income than lower income borrowers and mortgagees. Now, I have several similar misunderstandings or similar implications listed on the handout. But I'll stop at that point and simply say that people commonly look at these, the comparative size of the relative difference they of the out, relative difference of the outcome they happen to be looking at, and they draw inferences about processes on the basis of that. For example, people look at the fact that relative differences in mortgage rejection rates are higher among persons with higher income than persons with lower income and draw inferences about that, what's causing that. Or they might look at the fact that relative differences in mortgage approval rates are smaller among higher income applicants than lower income applicants. And they draw inferences based on the comparative size of those relative differences. Persons doing that, however, simply focus on the favorable, the adverse, or the adverse outcome they happen to be looking at, generally having no idea that if they were to look at the comparative size of the relative difference for the opposite outcome, they would draw an entirely different inference. In fact, probably never in human history has anyone drawn a sound inference on the basis of the comparative size of the of a relative difference in some outcome, and that applies to the social and medical sciences as well as the law. And no more than a handful of persons analyzing demographic differences are aware that it is even possible for relative differences in the favorable outcome and relative difference in the corresponding adverse outcome to change and operate in opposite directions as the prevalence of an outcome changes, much less that this tends to occur systematically. Anytime one sees a statement that despite declines in mortality, racial differences in mortality increased, in that situation they're simply looking at the common failure to understand that reductions in mortality will tend to increase rather than decrease relative differences in mortality while reducing relative differences in survival. But any time anyone says that despite improvements in cancer care, relative racial differences in survival have increased, well, in that situation, the person is almost certainly not talking about relative differences in survival. Probably the relative differences in survival will have decreased. The person, however, will be analyzing relative differences in mortality, which tend to increase as cancer care improves, while relative differences in survival tend to decrease. I'm now going to turn to the tables where I will illustrate these patterns that probably so far are not yet easy to grasp. Now, table one is simply explaining the terms at issue. It shows the pass rate for an advantage group and the pass rate for a disadvantage group. I call them AG and DG. The AG pass rate is 80%, the DG pass rate is 63%. So the AG pass rate is 1.27 times DG's pass rate. In other words, 27% greater than DG's pass rate. At this point, I'm simply explaining the terms I'll be using here. Now, Table 1B now illustrates the implications of lowering a test cutoff, say from the point where 80% of AG passes the test to a point where 95% of AG passes the test. Assuming normal test score distributions, DG's pass rate would increase from 63% to about 87%. Thus, the ratio of AG's pass rate to DG's pass rate would decline from 1.27 to 1.09. In other words, the relative difference decreased from 27% to 9%. This pattern is pretty well understood. That understanding underlies the view that lowering a test cutoff tends to reduce the disparate impact on tests of tests on which some groups outperform others. And then, page 7 of the handout just refers one to a table at the very end of this document, which simply explains, for purposes of people who are familiar with the 80% rule or 4/5 rule of the Uniform Guidelines and Employee Selection Procedures, that it doesn't matter which rate you use in the numerator of the rate ratio. For the purposes of what I'm discussing here, I like to put the larger figure in the numerator, because that way, the larger the rate ratio, the larger the relative difference. And I think that makes things easier to understand, and maybe that will be evident when I go on to Table 2. So now, I have included the failure rates in a table similar to Table 1. We see now the pass rate ratio that I just discussed is included in Column 5. It shows, as I just discussed, that if we lower the test cutoff, we reduce the relative difference in pass rates. But Table 6 now shows that if we lower the test cutoff, we increase the relative difference in failure rates. That ratio increases from 1.85 to 2.60.
Jim, I think you referred to Table 6, but you mean Column 6.
Thank you. Column 6. So initially, the DG's failure rate was 85% greater than AG's, and now it's 160% greater than AG's. Now, while most persons dealing with discrimination issues know that relaxing a standard lowering a test cutoff tends to reduce relative differences in pass rates, virtually no one seems to understand that lowering a test cutoff tends to increase relative differences in failure rates. Now, Table 3 adds to Table 2 a couple of more columns. Column 7, and this is the cumbersome issue I'm afraid I have to deal with because of the increasing focus on proportions groups make up of persons experiencing some outcome. And we see that Table 7 shows us that lowering the cutoff increased the proportion DG makes up of persons who pass. Here I base this on an assumption that DG is half the test takers. So the proportion DG makes up of persons who pass increases from 44% to 48%, thus reducing the disparate impact of the test from that perspective. However, column 8 shows us that lowering the cutoff also increased the proportion DG makes up of persons who fail from 65% to 72%, thus from that perspective increasing the disparate impact of the test.
Just a reminder for our audience, sorry to interrupt, Jim.
Sure.
The chart and a link to the chart that Jim is referencing is found on our blog. It's the second blog post down. There's a link within the post to the charts, and the name of the blog post is The Government's Uncertain Path to Numeracy. So just in case our audience members want a quick link, please continue.
Laura, were you saying a link to the handout that I'm discussing?
Yes.
Oh, have you put that in there just now? Cause...
Yes.
Oh, okay. Thank you. The next page, page 10, I repeat Table 3 in order to say a few things about it. And I've highlighted Column 6 and Columns 8, which are the columns people focused on adverse outcomes tend to use to measure disparities. Then I have a list of observations about Table 3. So, one is that observers focused on favorable outcomes would maintain that lowering the test cutoff reduced the disparate impact of the test. That's columns 5 and 7. Persons focused on the adverse outcomes would maintain that lowering the cutoff increased the disparate impact of the test. Column 6 and 8. Whether lowering the cutoff, in fact, increased or decreased the disparate impact is a fairly complicated issue, and I have some references where I discuss it. Now, assuming the two rows of Table 3 are based on the favorable and adverse outcome rates of two decision makers, there's no rational basis for maintaining that one decision maker is more likely to have engaged in discrimination than the other. Now, typically, people might be looking, if it's an adverse outcome, they would be looking at column 6 and saying the row 2 is a much greater disparity than row 1. But it's so far as we can measure disparity, so the strength of forces causing outcome rate to differ, there's no difference between the two rows. Now, assuming that the two rows reflect the favorable outcome rates as to the use of force by police officers or suspensions by school administrators, other things being equal, the more the actors follow guidance to limit adverse outcomes, the more their results will be like those in row 2 than in row 1. That is, they will show larger relative differences in adverse outcomes and will show more susceptible groups making up higher proportions of experience in the adverse outcomes. Focus will commonly be on columns 6 and column 8. Now, in many settings, the principal focus is on adverse outcomes. At least in the many settings that I'm focused on here. But even in those settings, there are many outcomes where the focus is on the favorable outcome. The Baltimore police decree, for example, in addition to examining criminal justice outcome issues, also examines disparate impact issues regarding hiring policies. Now, with regard to the criminal justice outcomes, the focus will invariably be on the relative difference in the adverse outcome or the proportion blacks and other disadvantaged groups make up a person's experience in the adverse outcome. Compliance with the mechanical aspects of the decree, things like adding more circumspection to the use of force, will tend to increase those measures. With regard to hiring, observers may be looking at relative difference in the favorable outcome, as in test scores, or relative differences in adverse outcomes in disqualification rates. Commonly, the persons looking at these things will have no idea that which outcome they focus on will determine whether they regard one situation to be more discriminatory than the other, or can regard the matter to be just the opposite. In criminal justice, one area, commonly people look at adverse outcomes. But in things like diversion programs, for example, typically people will focus on relative difference in being sent to the diversion program. You generally increase diversion rates, you will tend to reduce relative differences in rates at which people experience that outcome, but you will tend to increase the relative difference in rates between races of which people avoid the outcome or fail to get diverted. Table 4 is, I should have said when I mentioned the measurement letters that, and with regard to the second issue, can the government come to understand this? You'll see on the measurement letters page a host of letters to institutions trying to explain these. And some of these are scientific institutions, and some of them are governmental institutions, and some of them are public interest groups. And basically, none of them really understands. Whatever measure they use, none of these entities understands how to analyze demographic differences, because they fail to consider the way the measures they employ tend to be affected by the frequency of an outcome. Table 4 is based on income data that shows the black and white income rates of falling above and below various income levels. And columns 5 and column 6 provide fairly simple illustrations, and I'll suggest irrefutable illustrations of the fact that if you lower an income requirement, while you will reduce relative differences in meeting the requirement, you will tend to increase relative differences in failure to meet the requirement. Thus, in the case of mortgage lending, lowering an income requirement will tend to reduce relative difference in mortgage approval rates, but increase relative differences in mortgage rejection rates. Table 5 shows, and one of the letters on my measurement letters page is a letter to the recent letter to the Attorney General, hoping to cause this administration to finally to recognize this issue. But so far, all I've gotten from the Department of Justice is a couple of letters saying that, from particular sections, saying they do not regard my letters as constituting complaints within their purview. So it's going to be going to require something, and I don't know what that is, to cause the administration finally to understand this issue. Table 5 is the same thing as Table 4, but using credit score data rather than income data. It shows how lowering a credit score requirement will tend to increase relative differences, reduce relative differences in meeting the requirement, column 5, but increase relative differences in failing to meet the requirement. Table 6 is based on Department of Education data. And I should say the Department of Education is firmly of the view that relaxing standards will tend to reduce relative racial differences in suspension rates and will reduce the proportion blacks and other disadvantaged groups make up a person suspended. But this table shows the for both K-12 and preschool, the proportion black students make up of persons experiencing one or more suspensions and persons experiencing two or more suspensions, which I've misspelled. So let's suppose we relax standards such as two. Instead of giving everyone a reprimand instead of what would otherwise be their first suspension, well, the proportion of persons experiencing one or more suspension would, in the case of K-12, increase from 37% to 43%. The proportion of persons in preschool, it would increase from 44% to 48%. If you were to give persons a reprimand rather than the first two suspensions, those figures would almost certainly increase further. Almost invariably, you will find such a pattern. And one of the letters on my measurement letters page is a recent letter to the Departments of Education, Justice, and Health and Human Services. All have joined in the process of leading school administrators and public to believe that relaxing standards will tend to reduce the standard measures of differences in suspensions, relative differences in suspension rates, and the proportion disadvantaged groups make up a person suspended. In fact, however, relaxing standards will increase those measures. So I've urged these agencies at least to explain to school administrators and the public that the impressions these agencies have created is a mistaken one. Finally, the Table 7 shows, is based on data from a Washington Post article back in 2001, which discussed the effects of, in an effort to reduce the proportion of blacks made up of persons searched by customs, generally reducing the number of searches and requiring supervisor authority before anyone made an invasive search. This was thought of as a way of reducing racial disparities in search rates and reducing the proportion blacks made up a person searched. And frankly, the Washington Post article talks as if it actually did that. But you see, in fact, generally reducing searches, adding more circumspection to the process, caused the proportion blacks made up a person searched to increase from 14% to 27%. This typically, these patterns I described, they don't have to happen because other factors are at work. If, say, discrimination is playing into the process and one eliminates discrimination or reduces discrimination, that will tend to reduce all measures of differences between outcome rates. But typically, any substantial reduction in the frequency of an outcome, by restricting an outcome to those most susceptible to it, will tend to exhibit the patterns I've described here. Now, it'd be a good time to turn this over to Roger and to see the extent to which what Roger's observations are, and trying to divine the extent to which the points I've been making here have been comprehensible to the participants.
Well, thank you very much, Jim. This is extremely, interesting, I think, for anyone who is interested in civil rights enforcement, and in particular with the disparate impact approach to civil rights enforcement. Although, as I think you pointed out, some of the statistical points that you make would also be relevant in disparate treatment cases as well. Let me ask you about the reaction of left-of-center groups to this when you have approached them with these problems. I suppose that one response might be, if they agree with you, that, this just shows that we should get rid of this standard altogether. That is, we shouldn't be suspending students at all, or we shouldn't be, we shouldn't have a three strikes out or a two strikes out or a four strikes out policy. All of this is going to lead to racial disparities, and therefore we shouldn't have any of it. But I'd like to ask you to elaborate on what kind of reaction you've gotten from left-of-center organizations or left-of-center government agencies, and what kind of reaction you would predict, in a world where they understood and accepted what you have demonstrated here.
I think I don't get many reactions from left of center groups. Well, a typical, public interest group response is that we have a PhD who analyzes this material, and he disagrees with you. And to groups that analyze these differences, it's sort of a challenge to everything they do, regardless of, I'll call the liberal conservative implications of it. As to what happens when people really understand the issue, some people will say, this does reduce the absolute difference between rates, and relaxing discipline standards does reduce the absolute differences between rates. And some people who are strongly in favor of relaxing public school discipline standards will focus on that. And that's a a sound point, it still misses, it still reflects a failure to understand the way measures can only tell us about the processes at issue if we understand the way the measure is affected by the prevalence of an outcome. But if one were to suddenly start examining absolute differences, then one could no longer cite these seemingly huge relative differences as indications of how serious the issue is. Because in some people will say that, well, you've pointed out that there are some problems with the rate ratio as a measure of association, but it's still quite helpful in various contexts. And it might be helpful, but one must recognize that if you see the 3-to-1 disparity and if you argue that as a basis for relaxing the standards, that 3-to-1 disparity is going to increase further. So let me ask you, does that satisfactorily answer your question for the present?
Well, yeah, it does. Although, I mean, satisfactory in the sense that, you know, you've given a descriptive answer, but I guess part of what I'm after is more of a normative answer. You know, you would think that if some of the points you're making here would be of interest to a left of center group as well as one that's not left of center, but you know, maybe the problem is that they, you know, don't understand what you're saying, or that they suspect that there's some sort of ulterior motive, or maybe there's the, you know, the problem that, you know, if you make your living doing this kind of analysis, you're going to be reluctant to countenance any criticism that is going to affect your livelihood. So that explains part of the reaction. Has there been any history of judges dealing with the problems that you have identified here? Or to put it another way, are the distinctions that you're making ones that are consistent with case law, or does the case law tend to reflect the same misapprehensions that you've identified?
I'll say the case law, in the main, completely misunderstands the issue or has no understanding of the issue. A case, I have a web page on a case called Fisher v. Transco Services, where in a disparate impact case, an ADEA disparate impact case, the allegation was that the performance standard was unnecessarily stringent and disproportionately disqualified older workers, and the court cited a 10-to-1 disparity as, in its view, a huge disparity. But if you relax the standards, that particular disparity would tend to go up. The court completely failed to understand that. In cases about voter ID qualifications, courts have discussed the various measures as to what measure might they focus on, both with regard to relative differences in favorable outcomes, relative differences in adverse outcomes, and absolute differences, and with regard to which one they should focus on. And also that's the case in a case I have a webpage on called Jones v. City of Boston regarding a policy of terminating people for failing a drug test. And they talk about in the sort of why in favor of this measure versus the other measure. But when they do so, they invariably do so without understanding that if you modify the standard, you're going to change those measures. If you decide to In the Jones v. City of Boston, for example, the court decided to focus on the relative difference in disqualification rates. But say if you modify that standard in a way that tended to make it less rigid, you would tend to increase that relative difference. So then courts haven't grasped that aspect of the matter. Case of EEOC v. Sears Roebuck, 1984-85 case, which I litigated for the EEOC, in which the defendant won, the court in that case did recognize that that relative differences in favorable outcomes would tend to decrease as an outcome was rarer. And in fact, that's something everybody seems to understand. Everybody understands that as you get towards the right tail of a distribution, such as meeting standards for admission into very elite institutions, they recognize that that the rarer that outcome becomes, the larger becomes the relative difference in meeting it. But no one understands that the same thing applies to adverse outcomes. That if you were to relax an admission standard, you tend to reduce the relative difference in admission rates, but you increase relative differences in non-admission rates. In a case, an article I have called Race and Mortality, a 2000 article, not my 2014 article, Race and Mortality Revisited, I discussed it with regard to the affirmative action at elite institutions. Persons favoring affirmative action focused on the fact that elite institutions had smaller relative differences in graduation rates than non-elite institutions, while those opposing affirmative action focused on the fact that you had larger relative differences in non-graduation at elite institutions than at non-elite institutions. And that, of course, was simply a function of the fact that elite institutions tended to have higher graduation rates generally. And neither of these patterns of relative differences was telling us anything particularly useful about the processes at issue.
I noticed that a couple of points you qualified what you were saying as saying that this was, generally or, almost always the pattern that we see. Is that because the distribution patterns you're talking about are not always homogeneous, or is there something else at work that leads to exceptions?
Well, forces could be changing during the period at issue. But I think that sometimes it's because the distributions are not that normal, or there are oddities in distributions, and forces are changing over time. One thing where I make up important qualifications with regard to, in Baltimore, for example, because so much of the differences in outcome rates in Baltimore turn on the racial makeup of particular neighborhoods. I mean, if, for example, in general, reducing adverse outcomes pursuant to the Baltimore decree will tend to increase the measures that the monitor is probably going to use. But to the extent that the decree causes, say, less policing in predominantly or overwhelmingly black neighborhoods, or less aggressive policing in those neighborhoods, that could affect the measures of differences in any number of ways. In my article about New Jersey racial impact laws, I mentioned that probably the relative difference in incarceration rates was smaller before the recent general reductions in incarceration rates in New Jersey. And on that point, I was mistaken. And in fact, it had been reduced somewhat. And with regard to incarceration, people tend to get incarcerated for different crimes. So if, say, prison reform focuses on particular types of crimes and says, well, we were too harsh on this group of crimes, and you know, the racial makeup of persons affected by or committing those groups of crimes will, you know, play into the ultimate results in ways that's very hard to predict and will by no means necessarily track the patterns I describe. But it's still necessary to know the patterns I described in order to interpret data on processes and come to understand whether, you know, forces causing rates to differ are increasing or decreasing over time.
Very good. Laura, did you want to invite questions from the audience?
Yes, let's go to audience questions. When we get to requests, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. To request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. Floor request mode has been initiated. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing a question, I'll make a brief announcement. Our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Tuesday, July 25th at 12 noon. That call will be on the global politics of internet regulation, actors, and trajectory. It will feature Will Hudson, Senior Advisor for International Policy at Google, Patricia J. Paoletta, Partner at Wiltshire & Grannis, Sally Wentworth, Vice President of Global Policy Development at the Internet Society, and finally, our moderator, Umair Javed, Associate at Wiley Rhine. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming calls and to consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleform calls you may have missed. Let's go to our first question from the audience.
Hi, this is Robert Steinbuch from the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. I'm a law professor. And I was wondering if the speaker can comment on the research that, amongst others, Richard Sander out of UCLA has done regarding admissions, where he sees that the biggest factor, I think, is the disparity in admissions from the mean, what he calls the mismatch. And so the greater that mismatch of any student admitted, but of course it's prevalent amongst minorities due to affirmative action, the far increased chances of not succeeding, whatever that measure is. In the context of law school, it's ultimately passing the bar exam. And I was wondering if any relationship you see between that premise and what you've been discussing today.
I'm familiar with that work by Professor Sander and Stuart Taylor, and which I sort of, you know, intuitively agree with. I've never really studied the consequences of it, because on the one hand, one gets the value of an elite degree, which has some value, whether or not you do well at the institution or whether or not it helps you pass the bar exam. But, I mean, the points they make are all intuitively valid. I don't know that the patterns I describe, you know, necessarily play into that. I know that Sander's written about bar exams. And, for example, I think one thing people don't know is if you lower the bar exam cutoff, then you increase the relative difference in failing a bar exam. But your direct question, no. I'm not sure that that the phenomena I describe necessarily plays into the patterns that Sanders describes.
Thank you.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing another question. Roger, do you have any more questions you'd like to ask?
I was going to ask Jim about, you know, what is to be done? You have noted, I think, at the outset that Congress and, you know, the legislative branches have never really understood this issue, and I'm fully prepared to believe that the courts have not done a very good job with this, that the executive branch has not been very receptive, that the different, you know, interest groups that you've contacted have been unresponsive one way or the other. I mean, is this hopeless, or one thing I was going to suggest that this is just another reason why the disparate impact approach to civil rights enforcement is unlikely to work very well. Although some of the problems that you pointed out would continue to manifest themselves even in disparate treatment cases that relied on statistical evidence. But what's your prognosis for how
well,
this
works? Well, first off, with regard to disparate impact, I mean, there's a possibility that the disparate impact theory could be regarded as constitutionally vague. But in my April 13th letter to Attorney General Sessions, I urged the department to form a committee to generally address these issues. And, of course, someone in the department has to read that letter and form the committee. But the current administration has a strong interest in learning these things. I mean, if the Department of Justice could, or some other agency could, form a committee to study this issue, it wouldn't be an easy job. But it would go beyond these discrimination issues we're discussing here and just address the problems and the analyses of demographic differences in the social and medical sciences, which is a pretty serious problem. That would be ideal, but it's a matter of getting someone in authority to understand the issues and take the actions that that understanding, in my view, ought to compel. There's the Commission on Evidence-Based Policymaking that I've urged to also to address these issues. But that's the kind of thing that we'll see. I would say right now, none of the members of the commission understands these issues, and whether my lengthy comments I submitted to them will have any impact is questionable.
Well, we appreciate your patience and persistence in trying to get people to pay attention to this to this problem, and here's hoping that eventually somebody will wake up to the problems that you've identified.
Yes, I think, you know, Congress could, if Congress really, any number of committees, of congressional committees, this matter is within their purview, and I think one of the things I recommend of the Commission on Evidence-Based Policymaking is that it urges Congress to form a committee to start to address these issues. But Congress spends an awful lot. We have the problematic law enforcement issues, and we also have the problematic research issues, and a great many taxpayer dollars are expended in the latter area, while yielding little of value and a great deal that is misleading. So I also urge the American Statistical Association to form a committee to address the issues, but their view was, well, I'm handling it well enough, and they can't add anything.
Well, I guess that's a compliment. Laura, any other questions?
Not at this time. Oh. We have another audience question.
Yeah, this is Mike Tremolia of the Philadelphia chapter. And I have a comment, I guess, to make. Roger, I think you're familiar with my work about police shootings and how the press has skewed the racial aspect of it. And in some cases, some civil rights organizations have outright distorted the truth. But I have a colleague, well, not a colleague, but a friend who is a criminologist. In fact, he's a world-renowned criminologist who has done some groundbreaking work in probation and parole. And as he tries to impart these concepts onto city governments and state governments, he's finding out that many in the civil rights community are opposed to these policies because there would be an imbalance of black versus white, and that ultimately is just hurting the black community and the Hispanic community. What are your thoughts about that?
That's directed to Roger, right?
Yeah.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Mike, for the question and also for your good work in this area. Yeah, no, I agree. I think that, you know, this is part of a larger problem which you and Heather McDonald and Jason Riley in a book that he's just come out with called False Black Power all talk about, which is that the interests of the African-American community and particularly disadvantaged poor African-American communities is in favor of better and stronger law enforcement, not less law enforcement, and certainly not policies that are driven by statistical disparities that are not only problematic for the reasons that Jim has talked about today, but that are rooted not in discrimination by the police or anyone else, that are related to the fact that you know, unfortunately, different groups commit crimes at different rates, and that ignoring that fact is not going to help law-abiding people in high-crime areas. To the contrary, it's going to hurt law-abiding people in high-crime areas, and those people are themselves more likely to be poor and black.
Let me add that with regard both to the questioner's and Roger's observations, that I think those observations apply equally to school discipline issues, because I think that this unwarranted focus on disparities and suspensions causes those examining the utility of stringent discipline policies to fail to objectively consider the value of having stringent discipline policies.
No, that's well said, Jim, that when you think about it, if teachers are discouraged from disciplining students, if that discipline results in statistical imbalances, you know, racial imbalances, they're going to be pushed either to discipline some students who happen to be white or Asian who shouldn't be disciplined, or more likely they will stop disciplining some students who really ought to be disciplined. And when that happens and there's more disorder in classrooms, the people who are going to be hurt by that are the other students. And those students, you know, once again, are themselves much more likely to be themselves African American and poor.
I'll make a final call for questions. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any, and since we're running up on time, would either of you like to make some closing remarks?
Jim, I'll leave that to you.
No. Well, I guess that any participant who's interested in these issues, you know, there are a lot of references in that handout that I mentioned, and anything those participants can do to cause these issues to be more seriously considered, both by the academic community, by the executive branch, by the legislative branch, or by the judicial branch, would be of value.
And I will add, as I indicated earlier, that I think that the problems with the abuse of statistics in this area is just one more reason why the whole disparate impact approach to civil rights enforcement should be discarded, and that, you know, the focus should be on disparate treatment on the basis of race and ethnicity and sex and so forth, which is what discrimination really means.
Just a reminder that a link to Jim's materials and his website can be found on the Teleform event page on our website and on his blog post. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.